We're going to look at the seventh chapter of the book of Daniel in our study today. We have completed our study there in chapter 6. I've always looked upon the seventh chapter as being a very important chapter, not only because it deals with three important visions, but it also has to do with the beginning of the prophetical section of the book of Daniel. Most of the six chapters that have gone before have to do entirely with historical matters that were accomplished during the time of Daniel's stay in Babylon. But he's going to see in some of the visions in chapter 7 and 8 and all the way over to the end some events that are going to transpire in our generation and all the way until the Lord Jesus comes back. We might make a few introductory remarks regarding this seventh chapter. This chapter chronologically precedes chapter 5 and 6. You say, well, if it did, why didn't they put it that way? The only reason that I can give is because they're separating the prophetical part of the book from the historical part. And so that's why they have it in the order that they do here. The visions that we'll read about in chapter 7 took place some 23 years there between the death of Nebuchadnezzar and the fall of Babylon. The precise time of the visions cannot be known, but they did take place sometime during the 23 years from the death of Nebuchadnezzar until the fall of Babylon. That's about all we can be sure of. I would assume from what I've read thus far in the book of Daniel that Daniel is somewhat in a retired life when he has these visions there in chapter 7. He's still somewhat active in the government, but he's not, shall I say, going down to the office every day of the week. He is probably just giving advice and counsel and nothing more than that. It's also remarkable that both Daniel and John were very old when they received their revelations. Daniel was an old man, 80, maybe 90 years old, when he received a lot of these visions. Both Daniel and John were old. Both Daniel and John are said in the Bible to be greatly beloved of God. Both were known for their great faithfulness that they performed toward the Lord. So there's quite a parallel between John, the revelator, as we sometimes call him, and Daniel the prophet. They were, well, what one of them was to the Old Testament, the other one was to the New Testament. Now, in this chapter, there are three visions. We shall not study all of these today, but the high point of this chapter is the three visions that Daniel had. There's the vision of the four winds and the four beasts that's found in verse 1 to 8, and that will be our study today. Secondly, there is the vision of the judgment seat. That's seen in verse 9 to 12. And thirdly, there's the Son of Man receiving the kingdom, as seen in verse 13 and 14. I do not know for sure, but I would gather that Daniel may have had all of these visions on the same night. I cannot prove that, but I gather that he did from the way the account reads here in chapter 7. So they were probably all seen on the same occasion, though we cannot be sure. Well, I suppose most anyone that has ever read the book of Daniel is familiar with the vision of the four beasts. Sometime if you want to be amused, you can read some amillennial interpretations of the four beasts, because some people say they're the four gospels, and some of them say that they're this, that, or the other. But it's best to understand that they are four worldwide empires that began with the Babylonian rule and went all the way to the time of the Roman Empire. All of these four empires followed in succession, one to the other. And I believe that's what Daniel's vision was, world history, or world empires. Now, beginning in chapter 7 at verse 1, we have the vision of the four beasts in verse 1 to 8, and that's what we'll look at. We have in verse 1, though, the time that this vision occurs. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matter. Well, it's very evident from what is said there that this dream and vision seem to have occurred in the first year of Belshazzar. That would be about somewhere between 553 B.C. Other scholars would say 541 B.C. So it's somewhere near the time of about 550 B.C. to roughly round off the figures that are given there. You'll note that the term dream is in the singular, while the term visions is in the plural. He had the dreams and the visions while he was up on his bed. So that would tell us that it all occurred at night time. It occurred at night. Of that we can be certain. You say, well, if he dreamed those dreams at night and all of that, while he was there up on his bed, it says that he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matters. When do you suppose he wrote it down? Well, I don't know, but I would say logically probably the next morning. He wrote it down. Why? Because he knew it was a very important dream. Was a vision that would be needed for men to understand the march of Gentile world empires from his day all the way to the second advent of Jesus Christ. Now, who he told the sum of the matters to, I don't know. Probably some of his close friends, his companions, or something. It may be that he told them in the sense that he wrote them down, and therefore no individual would be as suggested in the idea, you see. So anyway, he had a dream and he had some visions, and he recorded these. I'm glad he did, otherwise I would have never known anything about it. And we would not have the seventh chapter of Daniel that we study today. And then we go down to verse 2, and we have the four winds that blow upon the Mediterranean Sea. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the great sea. Now, these dreams or visions had to do with the sea and some beasts that he saw. I believe that he's going to see in a measure what he saw back in chapter 2. Except it was not Daniel that saw it. It was Nebuchadnezzar the king, and Daniel, of course, gave the prophetical interpretation. So in a sense, he saw it, even in a greater sense than did the king. That's why I said what I did. So this vision has to do with that same subject of the four world empires before the second advent of Christ that we studied back in chapter 2. Now you'll note that he said there that the winds, They strove upon the great sea. There's not the least doubt in my mind, but what the great sea that he mentions there is the Mediterranean. That was a famous sea in his day that was near him, and it was called the Great Sea sometime in the Bible. You say, well, it's not uncommon for the winds to blow out in the open sea. What was so significant about the winds blowing on the sea? Well, it means that the winds are moving the sea. They're moving the sea, causing it to rage and move about as in a storm. In other words, he saw a storm upon the Mediterranean Sea. That's what we're being told there. But I believe that striving of the winds is a picture of God's sovereign power by which he acts upon the nations of the earth. Let me take a little time to prove from the Bible that the sea is often used as a figurative term for, well, the nations of the earth. It's true in the book of Isaiah, the book of Daniel, the book of Ezekiel, the book of Revelation, and the like. We'll note just a few this morning, though. In the 17th chapter of the book of Isaiah, verse 12 and 13, woe to the multitudes of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the sea. Now, people are being compared to the sea. Look at that. And to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. See the prophetic symbolism? Waters stand for nations. The nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters. But God shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. So you also have another example of it in the book of Isaiah, in the 57th chapter and verse 20. The wicked are like the troubled sea. So here the sea is being used to symbolize wicked nations. The nations as a rule are wicked, so the term is well taken. But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. Then you can go to the book of Revelation. You'll find pretty much the same. In the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, we have again the interpretation of the sea or the waters. In verse 15 of the 17th chapter we read, "And he said unto me, The waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." So we don't have to wonder about what the sea there represents. It represents the troubled masses of the nations of the earth. And whenever it is said that the wind blows upon the sea, it means that the sovereign power of God is being exerted so as to cause His eternal purpose and plan to be done in the troubled nations of earth. So that's what Daniel is seeing there. All of that striving of the wind in the four quarters, or the four directions of the world, points to the severity and confusion of this strife and worldly turmoil that will be going on throughout the time of Gentile dominion in the world. Then we go on down to the third verse, and we have the four beasts that arise out of the sea. Now we know already then that these beasts, whatever they are coming up out of the troubled masses of earth. That being the case, it surely must be world rulers that will arise out of the various nations of the world. And so that's what we have there in the four beasts in verse 3. "And the great beast came up, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from the other." They didn't look alike, but they were four in number. There are four directions spoken of here, and now there are four beasts. The number four in the Bible often is a number that is used to speak of the world and the world system. The four directions are of this world, you see. And so the number four has to do with the world and the world system. And surely that's true in our lesson here today. Again, this is the political sea of people that the beasts are coming up in. You want another proof text there on the sea being the troubled masses of earth? You might read sometime in Jeremiah chapter 46, verse 7 through 8. Now these beasts do not arise at the same time. They do not arise simultaneously, but they arise successively. You say, well, how do you know? Because he begins to mention the one that came first and second and third on down to the fourth here. He saw four of them come up, but not at the same time. They were coming up one, another, and another, and another after that. So that's a very important thing. And what Daniel is going to see here is world conquerors as God sees them. You know, when Nebuchadnezzar had the vision of that great metallic man, he saw himself as a great head of gold. Then he saw the breast and arms of silver, that was Medo-Persia. And then he saw the bottom part that was of brass. And then he saw the legs and the toes that were part of iron and part of clay. And what he was seeing there was the governments of the world as man sees them. They're valuable like gold. They're valuable like silver. They're strong like iron, and they're great like brass. But here we're going to see them as God sees them, as a bunch of wild beasts that are eating up one another, that are biting and devouring one another. So this is how God sees the events in the world, not as man sees them. I was reading this morning in the 68th Psalm, how that it is said there that men are like beasts. They're like beasts. You might recall that the Jews always called the Gentiles dogs. And when Paul referred to those evil rulers that he had to deal with at Ephesus, he said, from the figurative standpoint, I fought with the beast of Ephesus. Referring there to men, not to real animals. In Psalm 68 and verse 30, rebuke the company of spearmen, the multitude of bulls, with the calves of the people, till every one submit himself with pieces of silver. Scatter thou the people that delight in war. So whenever God wants to speak of warring nations upon the earth, he compared them to bulls, to beasts, to devouring animals of some sort. And clearly it is so there in this seventh chapter of Daniel that we're looking at. Now we look at the four beasts proper. Down in verse 4, we have the first beast. It was a lion. But it wasn't altogether a lion. It was somewhat of a monstrosity. It had two eagle's wings upon it. And I don't suppose that anyone has ever seen a real lion that had two eagle's wings upon it. So, you know, we take the Bible literally unless we can clearly see that it is symbolism. Well, first of all, we know that beasts don't come up out of the sea. They come up out of the land, but not out of the sea. So we know then, he's not speaking here from the literal standpoint. What he's saying is crouched in the language of prophetic symbolism. And so when he talks about a lion that has eagle's wings, we know that's not a literal creature. But it is a figurative way of expressing what he's about to make known. So the first beast is Babylon, and it had the appearance of a lion. What is remarkable is that the archaeologists in their uncovering of the city of Babylon have oftentimes found wing lions. They were carved in gold. They were upon the palace of Babylon. They were sometimes made in the form of statues, and they were up and down the avenues of the city. But it's remarkable that the lion was found as a symbol of the Babylonian Empire. And it's remarkable because when Daniel spoke of the Babylonian Empire here, he used the symbol of a lion. Have you ever thought about another nation that has that as their national emblem today? You remember Richard the Lionheart? You remember how that England has as their national symbol the lion. America has the bald eagle that's on the verge of extinction. And of course the Russians have the bear, the red bear, the Russian bear. So it's not unusual for a nation to have a symbol of its empire, its authority, and its power and all of that to be an animal of some sort. It's very common in our study of the scripture as well as our study of history. So the lion then is symbolic of the empire that was in power when Daniel was alive and writing this. Belshazzar was the second ruler in Babylon at the time Daniel had the vision and recorded this. Now in 1 Kings 10 and verse 20, you'll find that Solomon put up lions in his kingdom, no doubt to symbolize the great power and authority that he had. So lions do represent royal power and authority. Now, the wing lions guarded the very gates of the royal palace of the Babylonians. And please bear in mind that the head of gold in chapter 2 was the kingdom of Babylon. That we're having a parallel vision here, the one back in chapter 2. Now the sign of both the lion and the eagle were used by Daniel's contemporary prophets. If you'll read in the book of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Habakkuk, you'll find that they spoke about nations being like lions and eagles. They spoke about these animals often in their writings. So it's not unusual that Daniel would do the same. Now what would we think about when we think about a lion? We'd think about great strength and power. It's reputed that the lion is the strongest of the beast. So he's using that here to refer to the mighty power of the kingdom of Babylon. But now then, why would he use the term eagle? Why would he use the term eagle's wings? He doesn't so much stress the body of the creature as he does the wings there. The first was like a lion that had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man. And a man's heart was given to it. Now, what's meant there by all of that latter statements that we have there? Well, I believe that the eagle symbolizes swiftness of action. The Babylonian Empire was known for its swiftness of action. That's certainly true, but it says there that these wings were plucked off. What happened to it? Its king had insanity. Therefore, it could not make swift decisions and moves because the king for 7 years was empowered, he was impaired in his activities. And so that being the case, there was no way that the kingdom could act with that eagle-like swiftness that it had in times past. So the plucking off of the eagle's wing symbolized the loss of the speed and capacity for action that Babylon was famous for. Now, the latter part of the verse describes the change which came to Nebuchadnezzar following the time of his insanity. He got up off of his all fours and he began to act like a better man than he'd ever been before. He became concerned for the welfare of his subjects and for the well-being of the people in his kingdom. We'd say today that he became a great humanitarian. He began to act like a better man, not like a beast, but like a man that had been redeemed by the grace of God. So it all speaks about how that he was afflicted with a disease we call the canopy or boanthropy, and now he recovers from it. He's no longer insane, and he's a great humanitarian, and he begins to rule as a great humanitarian. That's what it means there about a man's heart was given to it. Man of compassion and feeling for other people. He had not had that heart before. No doubt he was given a new heart in regeneration, and that would account for all of it. Then he sees the second beast in verse 5, that is the kingdom of Media combined with the kingdom of Persia. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. Well, we've already pointed out that this is the Medo-Persian kingdom. Let's take a few moments to let the Bible identify this kingdom a little better. Look in the 13th chapter of the book of Isaiah at verse 17 and 18. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, which shall not regard silver, and as for gold they shall not delight. Their bow also shall dash the young men to pieces, and they shall have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes shall not spare children. So that verse speaks how that the kingdom of Media and Persian was known for its devouring characteristics. The bear is pictured here with three ribs in his mouth. He is eating his prey. He is showing no mercy. He is devouring much flesh. That was the characteristics of the combined kingdom of Media and Persia. Now the way Daniel starts off there, another beast, means one that was distinct from the lion, the first beast that he saw that rose up out of the Mediterranean Sea. Now the silver chest and arms of Nebuchadnezzar's image in chapter 2 is this beast, that is the second beast. Now when we think about a bear, it has basically two characteristics. It first of all is very strong. But then, if you know anything about a bear, it's awkward. It's awkward at the same time. And these were the characteristics of the kingdom of Media and Persia. They used a lot of troops in battle, but because they tried to be two federated nations, a lot of times they couldn't get their actions coordinated very well. And so they would be awkward in their battle campaigns, but nevertheless, with their great might and their great force, they did indeed devour much people. They showed no mercy on the conquered people that was subjected to their rule in the world. Now, note that there's something said about the bear. It's raised up on one side. You know, if a man did that, he'd be like this. He'd be crouched like this. Maybe he got one arm. He's raised up on one side, see. Maybe it would have been more like this because it would have been the right side that was raised up because that was the great strength of the Persians. Do you remember that the image had a right arm? The stronger again there in Daniel 2, the right arm was again Persia, just like it is here. The part that's raised up on its side, that's the part where the great strength lies. And that, of course, is in the case of Persia being the stronger of the two. So it was really a one-sided union. There was a very weak kingdom of Media that had united with a very strong kingdom that was Persia. Now somebody said, well, what about the three ribs that it had in its mouth? Well, I think that represents the many conquests that the kingdom of Persia and Media engaged in. But it probably points to three kingdoms that was conquered by Cyrus: Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. They were all conquered by the combined kingdoms of Media and Persia, but Persia doing most of the work. And what happened in that time? These three kingdoms formed what we'd call a triple alliance. And they did that in order to try to check these two kingdoms of Media and Persia. But the result was they were devoured by them instead. That's the three ribs that's in the mouth of this second beast here, the bear, as he's called. The devouring of much flesh would suggest how that this kingdom continued to make conquests and to take over more land than any prior kingdom that had ever lived in the world, reaching finally all the way from the Indus River on the east to Egypt and the Aegean Sea on the west. So the combined kingdoms of Media and Persia took in more world conquests than any kingdoms ever had in any prior time, more than Babylon, much larger in size than Babylon. And then we go down to look at the third beast, and that was Greece. That we have in the sixth verse. After this I beheld, and lo, another. That is, another beast, in addition to the lion, in addition to the bear. After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. Well, that's a monstrosity too. I never seen a leopard that had four wings, except in drawings. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. Now, when you bear in mind that Daniel is writing all this during the reign of Belshazzar, he's telling about these other kingdoms before they've ever come. And he's telling about the characteristics of them that any historian knows to be so. But it was all being done in the first year of Belshazzar. In other words, just about the time the kingdom of Babylon was getting ready to fall. And how in the world could he have known about what the Greeks would do hundreds of years after that, except by the revelation of God? And that's the great marvel of Daniel chapter 7. There was told to me about one fellow that was a great historian one time, that they took him to the 7th chapter of Daniel, and they read over the characteristics of these beasts, and they asked him if these were the characteristics of these kingdoms. He said, yes, it's exactly the characteristics of them. And he was astonished to see that a man had foretold all of this before it ever happened. But I think a lot of historians would do well to read the book of Daniel. I had a major one time in my church that was a great historian. And he made the statement to me after I had taught the 7th chapter of Daniel. He said, that is the most remarkable presentation of the history of those four empires that I have ever heard or read in my life. He was astonished, too, at the characteristics here that were given of these empires before they ever came into the world. Well, now let's look at the third beast, Greece, the leopard. Now, the leopard is not as grand and majestic as the bear and the lion. But the leopard is known for one thing, it's speedy. It's known for its great mobility. There's very few animals in the world that could outrun a leopard. It's known for its speed. It's also known for its insatiable lust for blood. It's a blood-devouring animal. Now, the Greeks were characterized by the swiftness of conquest. When Alexander went out to battle, he whipped them right quick. Just putting it blunt, that's the way he operated. He also had an insatiable lust for victory. There was no substitute for victory. To Alexander, there was nothing like having the victory over your enemies. And that was more true of the Grecian Empire than it was the Medo-Persian Empire. And of course, this is the lower part, the abdomen of the image back in chapter 2. We shall pass on now to look at some of the symbolism there. What about the four wings? The first lion had two wings, wings of eagles. But now we have four wings, and it doesn't say what sort of wings they are. It doesn't say whether they're eagle wings or sparrow wings or something is not said as to what kind of wings they are. All we know is that they're wings of some sort of a fowl or a flying creature. The two wings in Babylon have now become four wings in Greece. Well, under Alexander the Great, the borders of Greece were enlarged enormously and with remarkable speed. It's almost unbelievable that one nation of Greece could conquer as much of the world as they did under Alexander the Great. It's a marvel of history. You say, well, I'm still wondering about the four heads there. Had four wings. These four generals that he had, they gave him the great speed and mobility. But the beast had four heads. Now, what are these four heads? Well, I believe they represent the heads of government. And they point to the fourfold division of the government of the Grecian Empire after the death of Alexander the Great. Whenever Alexander the Great died, there was great division that took place in his empire. It really was divided between the four generals that he had. I suppose that was about the most logical thing to do, for had that not have been done, perhaps all the generals would have went to war, one with another. Being men of war, I guess they'd seen enough bloodshed, and so they said, well, let's sit down and we'll figure out what we're going to do with the empire. We'll divide it four ways. And evidently they agreed to it. The empire of Greece was divided among the four generals of Alexander as follows. Gesander was given Greece and Macedonia. Lysimachus was given Thrace and a larger part of Asia Minor. Seleucus was given Syria and much of the Middle East. And Ptolemy was given Egypt. Now bear in mind that I said here that Seleucus had Syria, that's north. That's what we're calling today Lebanon on the news. And Palestine now is in between Egypt and Syria. And in the 11th chapter of Daniel, there's a great outline of these conflicts between Egypt and Syria. And of course, in a measure, those conflicts, to some degree, are still going on in the world today. There's still a conflict of Palestine with Syria and a conflict with Egypt. In Palestine. To some measure, the scene is pretty much the same as it was throughout much of the history of the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the like. So the scene has not really changed all of that much. Before we leave that verse, I want you to note the statement there, and dominion was given to it, given to the leopard, given to the Grecian Empire. Now that simply means that God gave them their right to rule and to reign in the world. Alexander's dominion was granted by the providence of God. It became his, and after that, his generals, because God, in his overall supervision of history, saw fit to make it so. Otherwise, it would not have been so, you understand. And then this fourth beast, and you say, well, what was he? He was a nondescript beast. There wasn't any known beast in the world that looked like the beast that Daniel saw coming up out of the sea as the fourth beast. It had no parallel among the various beasts that he knew of in the world. He described the first as a lion, the second is a bear, the third is a leopard. But he's out of terms to describe the mighty Roman Empire that he saw as the fourth beast. The nondescript beast is Rome, and that's what we have in verse 7 and 8. After this, now that proves that they're coming up in succession and not at the same time. Have you noticed how that he says, after this, they're coming up in succession. They're not coming up at the same time. After this, I saw in the night's visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. So there we have the description of the fourth beast. It's almost a nondescript beast, but he described it as best he could. This is the kingdom of Rome that followed in succession of world empires after the time of the Grecian rule. It is the legs and the feet of the image back in chapter 2. Now look at the description of this beast. It was dreadful, terrible, strong exceedingly. That not only suggests that it had great strength, but it also was a fearful nation to contend with. I do not believe there ever was a nation on the face of the earth that brought any more fear to the heart of man than the legions of Rome. Whenever some little nation would hear that the mighty Roman legions were coming, they were ready to surrender almost at the very mention of the term. The Roman army was a well-disciplined army. And even though sometimes they were outnumbered, they would win the victory because they had great courage. The discipline of the Roman legions was well known. If a man had lived back in the days of Rome, to have been a legionnaire would have been one of the greatest privileges that he could have had in that day, because he would have been one of the greatest soldiers that ever lived in the history of the world. So Rome was known for its enormous strength and the fearful aspects of battle that it engaged in. It had iron teeth. Now, there's little strength to compare with the strength of iron. Well, the nation of Rome was an iron nation. There never was a nation so well disciplined by law, so well organized and so well given to its military campaigns as was Rome. You may not know the worth of the Roman Empire, but a lot of the laws that we have today are either based on Roman law or based on the laws in the Bible. Most all of our common law today goes back to the time of the Romans. Where do you think your calendar came from that you use from day to day? It's the Julian, the Roman calendar. That's what it is. We're indebted to the Roman Empire for the calendar that we have. All of the things that we do today in some measure or another are greatly influenced by Rome, though sometimes we don't seem to realize that. So all of this that we're reading about, the iron teeth, the dreadful, the terrible, and the things of that sort, speaks about how the Roman Empire would be devouring, breaking, stamping, how it would speak fear and terror in its tactics that would be used upon the nations that would be subjugated by it. All of that would be used by Rome in its conquest. You say, well, what about the ten horns? What about the iron teeth? Well, the ten horns and the iron teeth correspond to the iron legs of the image and the ten horns to the ten toes. So now you got iron legs, iron teeth. See the parallel? Then you have ten horns. Then you have ten toes on the image. So really you have the same thought, do you not? The iron rule of Rome. Now we've already seen that whenever there is a division in the empire, that it means there'll be other kingdoms arise out of that kingdom that exists. But then the remarkable thing is, down there in verse 8, says, there came up among them another little horn. A little horn came up. Now you got, what, you got the ten horns there, and then you got a little horn that comes up in the middle of the ten horns. Well, how many does that make? 11. Makes 11. You say, well, what was that little horn? That little horn is the Antichrist, the last ruler of the Roman Empire, the one that is soon to arise and be the chief of the United Nations of Europe. The future Führer of Europe is the little horn here in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 8. So the ten horns are ten kings. Daniel is told as much down in verse 24. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise. The Bible interprets that. And another shall arise after them. That little horn then is another king. And he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. So what we have there is a revival of the Roman Empire, not with one great ruler in Rome, but ten separate but federated nations, like we have in the common market, like we have in the future coming United States of Europe. And after these ten nations appear, not before, but after they appear, they have already appeared. There are ten nations now in the common market. Greece was the last to be added. There is, after the federation of these ten nations, to arise the Antichrist, the future Führer, the great world dictator. And so we're in the time now when we already have the ten toes of the revived Roman Empire. We have the ten kings. They have already come on the scene in the world. So what is awaiting? The appearance of the little horn, the Antichrist. So what I'm telling you is that time is very late. That the ten kings of the revived Roman Empire already exist. That we're just waiting for that little horn to appear. That little horn may have already begun to grow. The Antichrist may already be a small child. He may be a man. He may come to power at almost any time. So it's remarkable how that the whole history of the world, in a sense, is foretold right here in Daniel chapter 7. It's the greatest chapter almost in the Bible. Nothing like it anywhere in the world that we could read. So I do want to stress as I conclude the lesson this morning that we're in the time that the ten toes of the image have already appeared, the ten horns in the Roman Empire have appeared, and the only thing lacking is the little horn. Now when the little horn comes, there will be three nations in the ten kingdoms that won't go along with his rule. And so he'll devour three nations. He'll subdue three kings. So that means that the Antichrist will conquer three of those nations in Europe that will oppose his rule, that will be in the common market, or the United States of Europe. That has not taken place, but it will no doubt take place during the tribulation. That'll be the time when the Lord's church has been taken out of the world, along with all of the saints. So that means that we can go at any time. The toes are here. The little horn, no doubt, is growing, but yet he has not come to power. So the Lord may take his people out at any time. And as soon as he does, the little horn will begin the conquest of the three kings. In Revelation 6, you see the Antichrist, the rider upon the white horse. And then you see the red horse, and that's the war that he'll make when he subjects these three kings and conquers the whole world before it's over with. So really, the mightiest kingdom that the world has ever known was the Roman Empire. And that empire is no more, in the sense that, well, you still have Rome, Italy, and all of that, but you don't have all of the mighty empire except in its revived form of the common market. And so it's remarkable that Daniel said before the final dictator would come in the world that the devil would sin, that there would only be four great world empires. There would be Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And that while Rome would receive a deadly wound in that its imperial power would be forfeited, and the book of Revelation tells us that, 13th chapter, 17th chapter, yet the wound would not be deadly because the beast would arise again. And so what we've seen in our lifetime is the revival of the Roman Empire. When that was first preached back in 1920 and 30, nobody believed it ever happened except a few premillennialists. But now even our millennialists have to admit that it's already happened. It's already happened. So indeed, it has been fulfilled as Daniel the prophet foretold. Well, our time's just about gone, so I'll stop with that.